There's not much of anything for announcements tonight, of course, so we're still kind of on hiatus except for this online kind of deal for the next couple of weeks. If we're looking at through April, then that means for the next 2.5 weeks, we're doing this in one way or another. So my intention, if you were here or if you tuned in last week, you know that my intention for this week was to do chapters 11, 12, and 13 of the book of Genesis. I have a clock right over there, so I'll pay attention to it. I'm thinking it's one of those deals where I don't want to keep you all night, but I also know this is a fact. What else do you really have going on tonight? So at any rate, we'll see what we can do tonight. And actually, if I can have one of you guys maybe do this, tell people on the old Facebook machine to go to the website. That might be an easy answer if people are wondering if we're actually going to get going. So chapter 11 says, "Now the whole earth had one language and one speech. And it came to pass as they journeyed from the east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there." What we have in chapter 11, of course, the beginning of the chapter, will be the Tower of Babel. And in so many ways, as we'll see in just a couple of verses, as mankind is looking to thwart the commands of God, the plans of God, and man, as we've always been so good at doing, man at this point in his history, and of course this is mankind's history, is that he's just looking to do his own thing. So keep reading here. As we talked about this a little bit last week, the earth had one language, one speech. They journeyed, they came to the land of Shinar, they dwelt there. This, of course, is the area, the region of Babylon. "And then they said to one another, 'Come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly.' And they had brick for stone, and they had asphalt for mortar," or tar. "And then they said," verse 4, "'Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens. Let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth.'" This is interesting, and if you guys are note takers, you can just jot down a couple of these references. If you're a note taker, jot down Daniel chapter 4 and verse 30, and listen to what Daniel records for us of what Nebuchadnezzar says of himself, and just as he looks over Babylon, centuries from this event here in Genesis chapter 11, as he really commends himself for what he's created, what he's done, and the name that not only the city and the nation of Babylon would be, but who he is as a figure. Daniel chapter 4 and verse 30. It's also worth noting Acts chapter 12 and verse 22, where you have Herod kind of, again, commending himself for his greatness. Further, in this whole concept of mankind wanting to do his own thing, wanting to reject God, the ideas of God, the plans of God, the commands of God, turn back at your leisure some other time to Genesis chapter 3. Adam and Eve decided, and this was a decision that they made, to heed Satan's voice over and above the commands of God. It's actually interesting when you compare the geography of the initial portion here of Genesis chapter 11 to the garden in Genesis chapter 3. It's interesting that they're in roughly the same place there. Further, if we were to go back to Genesis chapter 6, the Nephilim in the Hebrew, they were the mighty men of the earth, or the mighty men during that time. They were men of name, is how it might be rendered. And everyone was trying to create a name for himself. And so fascinating, even again today in our day and age, one of the things that seems to be so prevalent in what people are aiming to do, hoping to do, hoping to accomplish, is to create essentially a name for themselves. Or we hear this word a lot, legacy. People are trying to create a legacy so that even when I'm gone, people will still know what or who. They'll know my name. They want a legacy for themselves. Now, this was Alan Richardson that said it this way: "The hatred of anonymity drives men to heroic feats of valor or long hours of drudgery." It's like, what can I do to advance me? What can I do to make a name for myself, even if it means kind of the sacrifice of family, the sacrifice of so many other things, so that I can become something. I can climb the proverbial ladder and I will be known. I'll be recognized. I'll be one of those who are known and who are renowned, and their name would be renowned. Interesting, actually. And even as you think about this, and this, we talked about this last week in chapter 10, Nimrod, as he began this whole thing, the connection is to Nimrod in chapter 10. If you remember, his name, the name that was given to him, this is so weird that his parents would have named him this, but Nimrod means "we shall rebel." And that was what he decided to do. Not only was that his own personal namesake built into who he was, but that's what he decided to do. So they decided to build ourselves a city and a tower. And notice this, it's a tower whose top is in the heavens. Let us make a name for ourselves again here in Genesis chapter 11, verse 4. Lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth. That last note is worth mentioning, as they said, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth. If you remember back in chapter 9, God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Where at this point they're saying, no, we don't want to fill the earth. We're content to be right exactly where we are, and we're going to build this thing to honor ourselves. And so this sacred tower, or essentially this sacred temple, was, if you were to kind of fine-tune it into what exactly they were hoping to do, was almost like this sacred high mountain whose peak was in the very clouds. They wanted themselves to be exalted. And honestly, this is so much of, again, even false religions and cults that want to be exalted as gods. And the problem, and this is a little bit from R. Kent Hughes, the great commentator, said the problem with the tower as such lay not in the desire to be in touch with God, but its underlying suppositions and approach. Its builders supposed that God was localized in direct contradiction to the explicit teachings of Genesis. And so the post-Diluvians had created a God in their own image. And he goes on to talk about this delusion is at the heart of every religious enterprise apart from the gospel, because the world's religions all teach, and it's a fascinating kind of a concept and it's a side study into itself, the world's religions all teach that works bring spiritual advance, as in an improved karma or works righteousness. And so this is man, again, exalting himself. This is man definitely rejecting God's direct commands to them. And of course, Nimrod, again, behind all of this, he's definitely, this is kind of a side note in and of itself too. And again, there's so much with this. And this is, let's just pause here. Let me kind of boil this down to the simple statement. The events here at the beginning of chapter 11 in the Tower of Babel are as important, if not more so, than the events of the flood of Noah. What this does on a world-shaping level is critical that the history is recorded for us, and critical that we understand it. Because even as we fast forward into end times prophecy, Nimrod, of course, he provides for us, he's definitely the model of the Antichrist, and the model of Antichrist's system. And his system mirrors the one world economic and specifically religious system that will come. Let's bring everything together. Let's combine it. We're not to be removed. Let's all be one. Let's all be together. Let's have a global kind of everything. And let's have definitely this global religion. And so fascinating further that this is in the region of Babylon. So there's a lot that could be discussed here, but let's move on. So verse 5, the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. And interesting, even the kind of the sense of this, the Lord came down to see the city. What was man trying to do? Go up to exalt himself, not to connect with God, but be on an equal playing field, an equal level with God. And at this point, God says, no, I'm going to come down and see what you guys are up to. The word picture here is almost like a grown man stooping down on his hands and knees, almost like with a magnifying glass, to examine an anthill. What are you guys doing down here? In a lot of ways, this is almost, it's almost a humiliating kind of a thing towards man, that the Lord would look from the heavens and say, okay, what are you cute little guys trying to accomplish here? You know, it's in Psalm 2, I think it's in verse 4, where the Lord just laughs at the attempts of man to reject God. He just laughs at it. He laughs it to scorn. So what are you guys trying to accomplish here, trying to create a name for yourselves? And verse 6, the Lord said, indeed, the people are one and they have all one language. And this is what they begin to do. Now, nothing that they propose to do will be withheld from them. Important distinguishing remark here. God was not threatened by this. This is more essentially, and I'll say it this way, prophetic pity. If man continues to go unchecked, if he continues to just move in the direction that's rejecting God, it will be bad for him. And at some point in history, as God recognized things will be terrible for man, at some point in history, this is where Romans chapter 1 would be a great tie into this. God just, he says, you know what, I'm going to give you over. You've rejected me, then go ahead and have it as you please, and the outcome will not go well for you. And of course, it's not gone well for us. This is not God feeling threatened, like, oh man, what are they going to do? Mankind's finally going to reach my level. That's not it at all. This is prophetic pity. So he says in verse 7, come, let us go down and there confuse their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. I had requested that you go and fill the whole earth, and now I'm going to start to make that happen. It's actually kind of an interesting parallel in some degrees. It's like an apples and oranges type of parallel. But if you remember that the church was to go and make disciples of all nations, what did they do? Well, they didn't. They stayed there in Jerusalem. And what was the thing that allowed them to go out, that forced them to go out? Persecution. So this is not divine persecution per se. Again, it's an interesting parallel, but it's an apples and oranges type of parallel, where the Lord will use whatever he needs to do to get his will accomplished and his plans and mankind in subjection to him. So he confuses language. So verse 8, the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of all the earth, and they ceased building the city. Kind of that project just ended. You know, there would have been tools lying around, and the bricks that they had built and baked, and essentially they burned this to make these building products for themselves. The asphalt or the tar that they had for mortar, just everybody kind of set aside everything and moved along. Now, if you've ever lived abroad, and of course we've had the great privilege of living in so many different places, or if you've either lived abroad or traveled abroad, you know, you kind of get somewhat of a sense of what this must have felt like. And just imagine, like, the next morning waking up and hearing all these, you'd never heard any other words before. Everything you'd ever known was in your language, and that language was, again, verse 1, everybody's language. It was the literal translation, one speech or one lip. Everyone had the same words, the same vocabulary, the same grammatic structure, et cetera, et cetera. But to wake up and hear different words, like what's happening, it would have been very confusing. We'll get to that in just a second. So having traveled a whole bunch, one of the things that I would find happening, at least for me, is I would be in an airport, and especially international airports throughout Europe, you know, all these different languages that were spoken around you. And at first, it's like so fascinating as you're trying to, wait, what language is that they're speaking? You're trying to figure it out. Or I think I know what that one is. And at some point, though, you just kind of zone it out and almost becomes like, you know, just this white noise and just this background kind of noise. All these different people speaking, and all you hear all these different languages. None of the words, or very few of the words that you know, maybe you're familiar with a little bit, but again, it just kind of fades into the background. And then when someone starts using a language that you have some sort of familiarity, it's like, well, it's almost like the volume of that language kind of goes up a little bit. Like, wait, I know that word. Ooh, I think they're speaking German over there. Or, ooh, those people over there are speaking English. And it's like, you can't help it, but you're just listening into their conversation. You know, it's like the volume of those words go up a full notch, and your ears latch onto those words and won't let go. So the confusing aspect and element of all of this would have been that people would have found their people groups, and they would have latched onto that, and then they would have dispersed from there. And so therefore, verse 9, its name is called Babel or Babel, because the Lord, or there the Lord confused the language of all the earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of all the earth. The Lord just put his work and his plan into place. And if you remember, we discussed this a little bit last week. This was this area, this city was the gate of God, and now it becomes known as the place of confusion. In Old Testament and New Testament prophecies, Babylon is always seen as essentially two things. Number one, it's the persecutor of God's people. And secondly, it's the embodiment of pride and vice. Now, there would be some who would continue to worship the true and living God. You know, you had Melchizedek, and we'll meet him in a few chapters. Melchizedek, or Melchizedek, he was a priest in Canaan. Job was someone that, of course, worshipped the true and living God. He living in the region of Arabia, but most people took Babel and took Babylon with them. And the structures that have been built around the planet, so many of those that mirror what this would have been. It's a fascinating kind of side study in and of itself. So here's Babel, and here's another interesting side note with it. Evolutionists have no answer as to why man is so different than animals. Animals that just make any kind of different sounds fairly unintelligible. They're able to communicate to some degree, but not in any way even remotely close to what we have. And evolutionists really have no explanation for it, nor do they have any real explanation, and how could they have an explanation for why there would be so many, not only different languages, but so many different ones. It's one thing to have different variations of the same language. What's the word I'm looking for with that? What is it? Dialects. Thank you. Different dialects of the same language, but it's an entirely different thing to have completely different, unconnected languages. So the Lord scattered them at that point. Now, verses 10 through 26, I mentioned this last week. This is kind of the retelling of Shem's descendants, and we were given much of that in chapter 10, so I won't belabor this section here too much, but this is the genealogy of Shem. And please note that, because this is once again one of these beginnings of another section that begins here with "this is the genealogy of." In fact, skip down to verse 27 for a moment here in Genesis chapter 11. This is the genealogy of Terah. And so that will be a major break by the time we get to verse 27. We have all of like primeval history to now getting to the patriarchal history, to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. So this is one of these major genealogies. And this is the genealogy of Shem. Shem was 100 years old, and he begot Arphaxad 2 years after the flood. And after he begot Arphaxad, Shem lived 500 years, and he begot sons and daughters. Arphaxad lived 35 years and begot Salah. And after he begot Salah, Arphaxad lived 403 years, begot sons and daughters. Verse 14, Salah lived 30 years and begot Eber. And we talked about him last week, and the namesake for Hebrew, or the Hebrew people, would have come from this man. And so he begot Eber. And after he begot Eber, Salah lived 403 years, begot sons and daughters. Verse 16 again, Eber lived 34 years and begot Peleg. And we talked about him, at least in some degree, last week, as his name means division. And he was born, or he was at the time when there was this division of the earth. And again, it seems to be the events of the Tower of Babel. So verse 17, he begot Peleg. Eber lived 430 years, had sons and daughters. 18, Peleg lived 30 years and begot Roy. And after begot Roy, Peleg lived 209 years and begot sons and daughters. Roy lived 32 years and begot Serug. And after he begot Serug, Roy lived 207 years, begot sons and daughters. Serug lived 30 years, begot Nahor. And after he begot Nahor, Serug lived 200 years and begot sons and daughters. And what you find here interesting as you compare this to both chapter 10 and chapter 5. If you remember back in chapter 5, you know, all these great men and these notable men, and those that are in the line, of course, leading up to Noah, they lived for hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of years. And now at this point in history, after the flood, the longevity, or let's say that the lifespans of the length of the lifespans of these people, of mankind, was drastically shrinking. They still lived long lives. It wasn't quite to that 100 years and change kind of thing that would come, but the lifespan was definitely shrinking at this point. So He begot Nahor, verse 23, after he begot Nahor, Serug lived 200 years, begot sons and daughters. Nahor lived 29 years, begot Terah. After he begot, verse 25, Terah, Nahor lived 119 years, begot sons and daughters. Now Terah lived 70 years and begot Abram or Abram, Nahor and Haran. I think this is fascinating. There's a lot to it. This is where I so encourage you. Like, if your only intake, if your only study of the book of Genesis is like me on Wednesday night or Sunday morning from several years ago, this is not me throwing myself under the bus or something, but you're missing out. I definitely encourage you to get a commentary or two. BlueLetterBible.com is a fantastic resource for not just some written Bible commentaries, but some audio Bible commentaries, some great Bible teaching as well. But there's so much actually in this section, and the number of the genealogies or the number of descendants, and it's really important stuff if you want to dig into it. But that's up to you, and I don't want to spend all night doing that. So this is verse 27, the genealogy of Terah. Terah begot Abram, Nahor, and Haran. And Haran begot Lot. And Haran lived before his father Terah in his native land in Ur of the Chaldeans. And then Abram and Nahor took wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai or Sarai. And the name of Nahor's wife, Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah, and the father of Iscah. But this is important. Please note verse 30. This is going to set the table for a lot of what's going to come in the subsequent chapters here in Genesis. Sarai was barren. She had no child. And Terah took his son Abram and his grandson Lot, the son of Haran, and his daughter-in-law Sarai, his son Abram's wife. And they went out from them. Went out with them from Ur the Chaldeans to go to the land of Canaan, and they came to Haran and dwelt there. Notice that Haran is also this place. It wasn't just Terah's, his son. This is now, it gets confusing with like, is that the guy or is that the place? It's the place now here. So the days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. So again, the difference between the age and the difference between the chapter 5's kind of genealogy and chapter 10's Table of Nations and the genealogy there. There's several different things that I encourage you to dig into that a little bit on your own. So now we're introduced to Abram. Chapter 12 says, "Now the Lord had said to Abram, 'Get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house, to a land that I will show you.'" Now, what I want to do is just make a quick mention of this, the kind of, when was the timing of all this? Because they had already left Ur of the Chaldeans, right there in verse 31. They had come to the region of Haran, but this was, when had the Lord spoken to Abram? If you remember back in the book of Acts, where Stephen gives his, let's call it his speech, that really gives the history of the Jewish people and how the history of the Jewish people was filled with people who had rejected the Lord. He offers some insight into the timing of when all this works. Again, that's kind of a side note, but I'd encourage you to dig into that. But the other thing that's really helpful with this, if you want to turn over there and hold your place there for just a second, this is over in the book of Hebrews, and this should be no shocker to you if you've studied Hebrews, and we just went through that a few months ago or so. But in Hebrews chapter 11, we have the hall of faith, and we have some of the hallmarks of people who lived by faith and what they did, what they accomplished, how they followed God, obeyed God by faith. So this is Hebrews chapter 11, verse 8, that says, "By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to the place which he would receive as an inheritance, and he went out not knowing where he was going." Back here in Genesis chapter 12, the Lord, this is Yahweh, speaks to Abram, says, "Get out of your country, from your family, from your father's house, to a land that I will show you." And again, there in Hebrews chapter 11, he went out, he obeyed God. The faith part was the obedience. And the obedience meant, though I don't know where I'm supposed to go because God hasn't shown me yet, I'm going to obey. Can you imagine that? That he just left home. And you have to understand just the absolute level of faith that this this took, that this required of him. Abram, man, when you study not just him, but when you study the historic context behind this and the archaeological discoveries behind this, the people there in Ur of the Chaldeans, they were moon worshipers. Their lunar religion dominated all areas of life. One commentator basically put it, from birth to the grave, everything they did revolved around their lunar worship, their moon religion. In fact, we find from Joshua chapter 24, it's not just extra-biblical like archaeological studies and whatnot, but Joshua chapter 24 tells us that Abram and his family, they served other gods. Abram, he was just a garden variety pagan. And so the faith of this pagan, he was advanced in years. We discover in the book of Genesis that he was a wealthy man, had a great family, beautiful wife. Everything would have been just great for him. But then he heard the voice of God. And he had actually heard God's voice. All these other false gods, all this worship of the moon provided nothing. And you wonder, even back here in the book of Genesis, even in chapter 11, as they were hoping to build this tower, almost this mountain into the heavens, into the clouds, maybe they're thinking, we've never heard from God before, and maybe we'll have a chance to hear him, and maybe we'll be on equal footing with him. They had never heard his voice before. And here, they should have known. And even their common language should have caused them to live lives of faith. Instead, they rejected him. But Abram, he hears God's voice. And so the aspect of his faith is really in so many ways beyond measure. So him serving other gods and the faith required to go, to leave your father's house, go to a land that I will show you. Again, there in the book of Hebrews, says in verse 9 of chapter 11, the book of Hebrews, by faith he dwelt in the land of promise as in a foreign country. We'll get to that. Dwelling in tents as with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise, for he waited for the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. And so here was a man who had everything kind of going for him, but he heard the voice of God and obeyed. And so the Lord spoke to him, get out of there. Again, back here in Genesis chapter 12, verse 2, God made this promise to him. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. There's so much to this as well. And this is a massive contrast right there in verse 2 of chapter 12. The Lord was going to make his name great. The massive contrast was to those in chapter 11 that were trying to make a great name for themselves. They were trying to be something great. And the Lord says, no, I'll do it. In fact, as you look at this Abrahamic covenant, and this is going to be repeated in several different places in the book of Genesis, this covenant, this promise of God to him, this is what the Lord would do. What was the condition? There's no condition. It's simply Abraham believing what God declared to him. So imagine kind of the power of this faith, almost the audacity of the faith here of Abram, as he says, I'll make your name great. You shall be a blessing. And verse 3, I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you, and in you all the families of the earth will be blessed. So all these promises to him, and especially there in verse 2 where God says to him, I will make you a great nation. Well, do you remember this? And I highlighted it in chapter 11 and verse 30. His wife Sarah was barren. They had no children. And he is now getting older. Abram, I'm going to make a great nation of you. Okay, well, it's just me and my wife. We have no children whatsoever. So the level of this man's faith is really just so astounding. And in so many ways, up to this point in the book of Genesis, therefore in the Bible, in biblical history, we have Abraham and, of course, we have Noah, these rich examples of faith and obedience. I should note two quick things, parallels between the lives of obedience, the lives of faith of Abraham and Noah. They'd be these two things. Number one, they weren't sinless. They weren't sinless. These men were not perfect. Think about Noah, kind of post-flood. He's a drunk. Think about what we're going to see in just a few minutes here with Abraham, or Abram, post-promise, after this promise. He turns out to be a liar. So that's the first thing to note. But the second thing to note in terms of these rich examples of faith and obedience of Noah and Abraham, by the time we get to the New Testament, to the New Covenant, again, especially there in Hebrews chapter 11, there's not a word, there's not even a hint of their failure. When we're now coming to God by His grace, and this is always how we come to Him, it's always this belief in what He has declared. And we'll see that so clearly later on, not tonight, but later on in the life of Abraham, the man of faith. The Lord does not hold our sin against us. And so we're sinners living as pilgrims until heaven, and God's grace is greater still. And so there's a lot of rich examples here from him. So this blessing upon him, and by faith Abraham obeyed when he was called to go and do this. We could talk about this as well, this call to follow God in so many ways is very much like the call to discipleship, very much like the call of the gospel, to leave country, to leave people, to leave family. It's discipleship 101. It's the willingness to follow, to obey, to let go of all of those other things, and he chooses to do so. There's a lot in this section. So verse 4, Genesis chapter 12. Abram departed as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot went with him. Now that'll be an issue for some time to come, but this immediate family went with him. And Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. And Abram took Sarai, his wife, and Lot, his brother's son, and all their possessions that they had gathered, and the people whom they had acquired in Haran, so their household servants, the people, like basically employees, we'll see later on in his life that he had these trained servants. And they departed to go to the land of Canaan. So they came to the land of Canaan. Abram passed through the land to the place of Shechem, as far as the terebinth trees, or some of your translations might say the oak tree of Morah. And the Canaanites were there, or then, in the land. This is a fascinating kind of a thing here, because what he found there with this terebinth or this oak tree at Morah, Morah means teacher or oracle giver. And so likely people would have gone to that tree, to that place, and that's where they practiced their soothsaying or they practiced their idolatry. And there's some that would make the comment that they would even just stop and listen for the rustling of the wind through the leaves, and that would be the message. They would have someone that would come along and interpret, this is what the gods are declaring to us through this tree. And so what Abram greeted here, more paganism, more idolatry. It was Babel, just in a different place. It went everywhere. And then verse 7, the Lord appeared to Abram and said, to your descendants, I will give this land. So go, you know, to a place you don't know where it is yet, but he arrives here and the Lord says, no, this is the land. And there he, Abram, built an altar to the Lord who had appeared to him. This is amazing, and we'll get to this before the end of the evening. But we find Abram here building this altar. He was a man who lived in tents. He was a man who kind of forsook all of the normal comforts of life. And the one thing that we find him building, it's not a city. We find him building not just this altar, but altars through his life. This was a man who worshiped the true and living God. It's really a fascinating study throughout on its own. And it's kind of, where did he learn this? Did he learn it from his father who learned it from his father who learned it from, and where would they have learned it? Well, Noah, of course, offered sacrifice. He offered worship to the Lord. He built an altar to the Lord after he was able, with his sons and his wife and his daughters-in-law, to leave the ark. I wonder if this sacrifice that was made, I wonder if this hearkened all the way back to Genesis chapter 4 with Cain, but specifically with Abel, with the kind of intrinsic thing for them that we should worship, we should make sacrifices. And here he builds this altar to the Lord, to Yahweh. This is to the true and living God. And he moved from there to the mountain east of Bethel. And we'll come back to that place later on in our study of Genesis. And he pitched his tent with Bethel on the west and Ai or Ai on the east. And there he built an altar to the Lord and called on the name of the Lord. I think it was Martin Luther that translated that he proclaimed the name of the Lord, or he preached about Yahweh. He told all these other pagan people around him about the true and living God. Hey, you're not from around here. No, I'm not. But let me tell you about the God who sent me out to come and live in this land. So Abram journeyed, going on still towards the south. He's just moving along here, following the voice of the Lord, this journey of faith, this walk of faith. Now, again, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, Abram wasn't sinless. He had his fair share of mistakes, and his fair share of mistakes were, unfortunately, no different than you and I. He repeated them. It's kind of a fascinating study just in itself, like the heroes, the characters of the Bible, because it's super easy to criticize Abram here, and it will be in just a second. And he was a brand new believer to some degree, like it was an 800-mile journey from Ur of the Chaldeans to him setting up shop here and having his tent established there in Canaan. And all the different civilizations that he would have passed, all the different cities he would have seen along the way, 800 miles, but he's still a relatively new believer, relatively new follower of the true and living God. And what he knew from God was limited. He didn't have the Bible. He had what he heard from God. And so at this point, as we see him make what turns out to be a mistake that leads to sin, did he seek the Lord? Because notice what happens here in verse 10. There was a famine in the land, and Abram went down to Egypt to dwell there, for the famine was severe in the land. You know, what you don't notice here is him seeking the Lord, him asking God what he should do. So did he seek the Lord? Probably not. And again, it's super easy to criticize him for this, but have you ever done that? Kind of made a decision based on something? Maybe there's like a serious circumstance in your life. Well, we need to just do this, and hopefully God will bless it. And this is, I'm going to suggest, fear-based, as we're going to see based on his actions that will follow. There's definite fear in his life. And have you ever done that? Have I ever done that? Kind of skipped a step, and we probably have all done that. We even find this in the great man Joshua, generations from this point, that did not seek the Lord. And so this also serves for us as a great lesson in extending grace to other people. Well, Abram, he blew it. But you don't find the Lord, again, New Testament, there's not a word about this. There's not a word about it. It's really such a beautiful picture of God's grace. So they went out of there due to this severe famine in the land. They went down to Egypt. Verse 11, it came to pass when he was close to entering Egypt that he said to Sarai, his wife, "Indeed, I know that you are a woman of beautiful countenance." Baby, you're gorgeous. "Therefore, it'll happen." Like, this is definitely going to happen. "When the Egyptians see you, they will say, 'This is his wife,' and they will kill me, but they will let you live." Now, there's a bunch of things with this. First off, let's talk about how beautiful she must have been. And a lot of people, well, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. So Abraham, you know, just thought she was so pretty, and that just, he was just being really sweet to his wife. But in truth, what we find, even notice verse 15, skip down there for a second, or at the end of verse 14, she was very beautiful. The Egyptians saw this. The princes of Pharaoh also saw her and commended her to Pharaoh. Like, "Hey, Pharaoh, this lady is a beaut." So she was beautiful. And people talk about Helen of Troy, right? Her beauty that could launch 1,000 ships, that kind of thing. Well, Sarah's beautiful was in that category. Just absolutely gorgeous. She was 65 years old at this point. You think, well, okay, a little bit older, so she was pretty for her age. No, remember, she lived to be 127 years old. So if you kind of were to put that in ratios or whatever, this would have been roughly how we are today in our like 30s or 40s kind of thing. Beautiful, beautiful woman. So the other part about this, what is Abram asking her to do? Let's just say it. He's asking her to lie. Now, we don't exactly know this yet, that as he says, "Please say there in verse 13, 'You're my sister.'" We're going to find out in chapter 20, when he repeats this issue, that this is half true. This is his half sister. Interesting whole dynamic all to itself, and we'll probably touch on that in a couple weeks in chapter 20. But what's remarkable for me about this, as we think about his action here, he's again doing this out of fear. He's assuming the absolute worst. It's already a pretty dire situation. He needs to leave Canaan, the severe famine that's in the land. They come to Egypt. This is all unfamiliar. His wife's gorgeous, and people are going to like definitely want to kill me so they can just take you from me. He's assuming the absolute worst in the situation, and this is so dangerous. And unfortunately, so many of us are so good at this. He's also assuming the worst about other people. He's assuming what they will do based on his situation, based on who he is, based on who his wife is. Well, they're definitely going to do this. Like, is there any benefit of the doubt there, Abram? Do you want to have a conversation with those people? It's like, no, this is what it is. So the only recourse at this point, we have to lie. Man, that's quite a jump there for this great man of faith. But this is the decision. So please say you're my sister, that it may be well with me for your sake, and that I may live because of you. Again, what's so terrible about this? It's like, what's so telling about this is how selfish all this is. And it's, I mean, kind of funny almost, where say you're my sister, that it may be well with me for your sake. Because if it doesn't go well for me, then things aren't going to be good for you, sweetheart. Like, this is just, he's not worried about her. He's not worried about Pharaoh. He's not worried about Pharaoh's family. He's really just thinking about self. And when we're so self-focused that we're now fearful, we make some terrible, terrible decisions. And we kind of take the lives of others and put those in second place compared to our own lives. So it was, verse 14, when Abram came into Egypt, that the Egyptians saw the woman. She's very beautiful. The princes of Pharaoh also saw her and commended her to Pharaoh. And the woman was taken into Pharaoh's house. And he treated Abram well for her sake. Well, this is, you know, her brother. So I'll take care of the brother. He had sheep, oxen, male donkeys, male and female servants, female donkeys, and camels. Like, here, let me just bless you. This is interesting, too, because Abram would be blessed of the Lord. And I wonder, had he just arrived into Egypt, I wonder if he was supposed to go into Egypt at all. He didn't ask the Lord about this situation, he just left. But I wonder if he had gone into Egypt and just said to Pharaoh, actually, this is my wife and here's the situation, if he still would have been blessed. If he explained to Pharaoh about the true and living God, if the situation would have been different, I wonder. But we don't know. We find this contrasting statement here in verse 17. But the Lord, this is Yahweh, the Lord plagued Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. Like, thanks a lot, Abram, for, you know, you coming into our land, and this is the thanks that we get. Fascinating here, verse 18, Pharaoh called Abram and said, "What is this you have done to me? Why did you not tell me that she was your wife?" Here's my question. How does he know this? Does, you know, when we find in chapter 20 the same kind of scenario, God, this was with Abimelech, not Pharaoh, but God came to Abimelech and spoke to him in a dream. This is what's happening here. This is who she is. This is who this guy is here. Think about Jonah chapter 1, as this great storm had come up and all these people, including Jonah, were out on this boat on the sea. And they're like, hey, what are you doing? Jonah's just asleep, right? And the under part of the boat. What have you done? They cast lots, and it's got to be this guy. It's got to be his God is angry with him, and now we're all taking the brunt for him. I wonder if it's this. Is this plague is upon Pharaoh and his house, and great plagues, plural, because of Sarai. I wonder if, like, everyone was sick except for her. Like, she's fine. She wakes up, you know, everything's great around me, and, like, everyone's really sick. I wonder if they're looking like, hey, what's different here? It's you. And maybe they just asked some questions. Who knows? But this says in verse 19, why did you say, now Pharaoh calls Abram, why'd you say she's my sister? I might have taken her as my wife. This is amazing. He's now being rebuked by the world. That would have been wrong if I had done that to your wife. I might have taken her as my wife. Now, therefore, here is your wife. Take her and go your way. I wonder how much animosity was in his wording there. Here's your wife, not your sister. Here's your wife. Take her and go your way. So Pharaoh commanded his men concerning him, and they sent him away with his wife and all that he had. I was hoping that we'd have time to get into chapter 13. We'll skip it for tonight. Pick it up there in chapter 13 next week. Of course, Sunday morning we'll be live in one way or another at 10:30. So stay connected. Look for an email Look for Facebook messages. Look for, you know, notifications through the app. Stay well. Please do send us an email. Send the church an email if there's anything you need. Again, that's office@calvaryozarks.org. If you've got any prayer requests, send us a note. If you've got any questions about the chapter tonight, or excuse me, chapters tonight, send a note. Let's see what we can do to answer some of your questions. I know that you know, at least a couple of our elders are interested in, like, how else can we be connected rather than just here sit in front of a screen and listen to Pastor Jeremy talk a couple times a week. Like, what else can we do? Again, I'll say this. Hey, church family, talk to each other. Send a text. Send an email. Stay up, together with social media and Facebook and all those types of things. But you might even pick up the phone and call other people in the church and just see how people are doing. Covet your prayers right now as we just continue to try to make sense of all this. You know, pray for, man, the world. Pray for hearts. Pray for the leaders of our world as things are so quickly moving to that global level. And the global level that we've already been for quite some time is beginning to have some major repercussions. So it's an interesting thing, but, you know, just early this morning, we passed the 2 millionth person that was an officially confirmed case of COVID-19. So this thing is at 2 million, and it's not apparently going away. Hopefully it'll go away soon, but let's pray that hearts will be turned to Jesus during this time. So thanks for tuning in. God bless you. I'm going to reach over here and turn this off, and we will see you later. God bless you.